Strangers and Aliens, Episode 66, The Silver Chair and the Red and Blue Pills.
Welcome to the Strangers and Aliens podcast.
Strangers. To boldly say what needs to be said.
Would you be a stranger or an alien? Or would you be a strange alien?
The truth is out there. I am your father's best friend, Plumber. Superman.
Wonder Woman.
Heroes. Villains. Captain Picard versus Captain Kirk.
Do you think that there's room in sci-fi for God? The very first thing that God did,
so wise you are,
was that he created something, so we have a creative God.
This is Strangers and Aliens Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Strangers and Aliens. If you're strange and you're an alien, you're in the right place. I'm Dr. Jace O'Neill, and I'm here with two of my co-hosts, Ben Avery.
Hi, I'm Ben.
And Steve Big Mac Donald.
Hi. I hope I'm not that big. In fact, I was bike riding today to try to get a little less
nice.
Big.
But it's just your name, Mac, Big Mac, is just really cool sounding. Especially since it's MacDonald. Not McDonald, MacDonald.
That's right.
He does say so.
Yeah. The name's MacDonald, not McDonald's. These rhymes are Stevens. Those burgers are Ronald's.
So believe it or not, this is not a fast food podcast.
Not
we
at all.
We're actually a podcast on imaginative fiction, fantasy, sci-fi, mixed in with the Christian worldview. So Ben, why don't you lay it on us? What is our topic? What is the gauntlet that's been thrown for today?
Okay. Well, today we're going to be actually talking about every single thing you just mentioned, except for fast food. Sci-fi, fantasy, Christian worldview, it's all there. All right.
Have you guys eaten at Taco Bell recently?
No, but I've had their Dorito tacos. They're good. Okay, so
it's like you can't understand that I went there and like there was like 4,000 things on the menu and none of them made any sense.
Well, there's
so
the one called Tacos that I liked.
Yeah. So. I know. I thought I ordered one and then it wasn't what it was like it had goo in it.
Steve, we specifically said we're not talking about fast food today.
Oh, I know.
Okay. I just want to make sure you know. Okay.
And it's a Pepsi place, too. It's not
a Coke
place.
Here's what we're talking about today.
I vote from here on out that we don't refer to him as Steve McDonald, but we refer to him as Tangent McDonald.
Tangent McDonald.
Tangent's our new nickname for Steve.
Whatever, guys.
It's kind of a cool name, Tangent.
It is kind of a – that'd be a cool superhero name.
Exactly.
It was a superhero universe that DC did.
The Tangent
universe, okay.
Yeah.
So let's get back on track. So it is the year of C.S. Lewis. This month, we are reading The Silver Chair, and we are reading The Problem with Pain as like the bonus book. And we're discussing these books over at our Goodreads book club, the Strangers and Aliens book club. And I do want to extend the invitation for you to join us there. So this month is focusing on The Silver Chair. So this episode is going to be focusing on The Silver Chair. The title is The Silver Chair and the Red and Blue Pills, because we're going to be looking specifically at one of the most famous passages, definitely the most famous passage from the book The Silver Chair, but one of the most famous passages in all the Narnia novels. And that is where Puddle Glum confronts the queen of the underworld, so to speak, and how she was trying to convince them that basically Narnia did not exist. And she kind of came at them with this kind of skeptical logic. And yeah, so that's what we're going to talk about. And there's a lot of connections from this book to, you know, older books is it the Odyssey where they have the Lotus Eaters?
I think it's the
Odyssey,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, the Iliad is the war and the Odyssey is the trip back.
I thought it'd be fun for us to kind of take this passage from The Silver Chair and give it as a dramatic recitation. And so here is what we're going to do. There are a couple parts here. We've got the passage all in front of us. And I am going to play the part of narrator and the part of the prince. And Jace is going to play the part of the queen, the witch, and also the part of Eustace Scrub. Meanwhile, Steve is going to play the part of Puddleglum and Jill Pole. So, are you guys ready?
Okay, why don't we give a little bit more feedback here? Who's Puddleglum? Who's Scrub?
Yeah, let's get up to this position in the story, I guess, right?
I'm Puddleglum.
Yes, you are Puddleglum and you are Jill Pole. Puddleglum is Tom Baker. He's Doctor Who from the BBC version of this Narnia story. But Puddleglum is a Marshwiggle, and he is a creature that is indigenous to Narnia. He and the two human children from Earth, Eustace Scrub, who is now a much better person than he was at the beginning of Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and his friend from their school, Jill Pole, they were pulled into Narnia, and they were given a mission to rescue King Caspian's son, Prince Rillian. He went on a journey and never came back. He went out and actually wasn't exactly a journey. He just went out as on like his normal thing and never came back. Well, Scrub and Jill are sent out by Aslan to go and find him and bring him, rescue him. And they end up going to where these giants live, and they have these clues and stuff like that. They meet this witch, and it turns out she's the one who's actually holding the prince in a silver chair, and the silver chair wipes his memory, and it's all this kind of magic-y stuff going on. So right now, what we're going into right now is Puddleglum, Jill, the prince, and Eustace are about to enter into basically a battle of wits with the witch. They don't know they are, because they don't understand how powerful the witch is and what she can do with words and with ideas. But we're not going to give away the ending of everything, but we are, I guess, spoiling some of the book here by reading this to you. So, that said, are you guys ready? You know who you are?
Yeah.
I think we're ready.
Now, the witch said nothing at all, but moved gently across the room, always keeping her face and eyes very steadily toward the prince. When she had come to a little arc set in the wall not far from the fireplace, she opened it and took out first a handful of a green powder. This she threw on the fire. It did not glaze much, but a very sweet and drowsy smell came from it, and all through the conversation which followed, that smell grew stronger and filled the room, and made it harder to think. Secondly, she took out a musical instrument, rather like a mandolin. She began to play it with her fingers, a steady, monotonous thrumming that you didn't notice after a few minutes. But the less you noticed it, the more it got into your brain and your blood. This also made it hard to think. After she had thrummed for a time, and the sweet smell was now strong, she began speaking in a sweet, quiet voice.
Narnia,
she said.
Narnia, I've often heard your lordship utter that name in your raving. Dear prince, you are very sick. There is no land called Narnia.
Yes, there is, though, ma'am,
said Puddleglum.
You see, I happen to have lived there all my life.
Indeed,
said the witch.
Tell me, I pray you, where is that country?
Up there,
said Puddleglum stoutly, pointing overhead.
I don't know exactly where.
How?
Said the queen with a kind, soft, musical laugh.
Is there a country up there, the stones and mortar of the roof?
No,
said Puddleglum, struggling a little to get his breath.
It's in the overworld.
And what or where, pray thee? How do you call it? Overworld? Oh, don't be so silly,
said Scrub, who was fighting hard against the enchantment of the sweet smell and the thrumming.
As if you didn't know, it's up above, up where you can see the sky and the sun and the stars. Why, you've been there yourself. We met you there. I cry mercy, little brother,
laughed the witch. You couldn't have heard a lovelier laugh.
I have no memory of that meeting,
But we often meet our friends in strange places when we dream. And unless all dreamed alike, you must not ask them to remember it.
Madam, said the prince sternly, I have already told your grace that I am the king's son in Narnia.
And shalt be, dear friend,
said the witch in a soothing tone, as if she were humoring a child.
Shalt be king of many imagined lands in thy fancies?
We've been there too,
snapped Jill. She was very angry, because she could feel enchantment getting hold of her every moment. But of course, the very fact that she could still feel it showed that it had not yet fully worked.
And thou art queen of Narnia too, I no doubt. Pretty one,
said the witch in the same coaxing, half-mocking tone.
I'm nothing of the sort,
said Jill, stamping her foot.
We come from another world.
Why, this is a prettier game than the other,
said the witch.
Tell us, little maid, where is this other world? What ships and chariots go between it and ours?
Of course, a lot of things darted into Jill's head at once. Experiment house, Adelia Pennyfather, her own home, radio sets, cinemas, cars, aeroplanes, ration books, queues. But they seemed dim and far away. Thrum, thrum, thrum went the strings of the witch's instrument. Jill couldn't remember the names of the things in our world, and this time it didn't come into her head that she was being enchanted, for now the magic was in its full strength, and of course, the more enchanted you get, the more certain you feel that you are not enchanted at all. She found herself saying, and at the moment it was a relief to say,
No, I suppose that other world must be all a dream.
Yes, it is all a dream,
said the witch, always thrumming.
Yes, all a dream,
said Jill.
There never was such a world,
said the witch.
No,
no,
said Jill and Scrub.
Never was such a world.
There never was any world but mine,
said the witch.
There never was any world
but
yours,
they said. Puddleglum was still fighting hard.
I don't know rightly what you all mean by a world,
he said, talking like a man who hasn't enough air.
But you can't play that fiddle till your fingers drop off. And still you won't make me forget Narnia and the whole overworld, too. We've never seen it again, I shouldn't wonder. You may have blotted it out and turned it dark like this, for all I know. Nothing more likely. But I know I was there once. I've seen the sky full of stars. I've seen the sun coming out of a sea of a morning, and sinking behind the mountains at night. And I've seen him up in the midday sky when I couldn't look at him for brightness.
Puddlegum's words had a very rousing effect. The other three all breathed again and looked at one another like people newly awaked.
Why, there it is, cried the prince. Of course, the blessing of Aslan upon this honest marshwiggle. We've all been dreaming these last few minutes. How could we have forgotten it? Of course we've all seen the sun.
By Jove, we have,
said Scrub.
Good for you, Puddleglum. You're the only one of us with any sense, I do believe.
Then came the witch's voice, cooing softly like the voice of a wood pigeon from the high elms in an old garden at 3 o'clock in the middle of a sleepy summer afternoon. And it said,
What is this sun you speak of? Do you mean anything by the word? Yes, jolly we do,
said Scrub.
Can you tell me what it's like?
Asked the witch. Thrum, thrum, thrum went the strings.
Please it, your grace,
said the prince, very coldly and politely.
You see that lamp? It is round and yellow and gives light to the whole room and hangeth moreover from the roof. Now that thing which we call the sun is like the lamp, only far greater and brighter. It giveth light to the whole overworld and hangeth in the sky.
Hangeth from what, my lord?
Asked the witch, and then, while they were all still thinking how to answer her, she added with another of her soft, silver laughs.
You see, when you try to think out clearly what the sun must be, You cannot tell me. Your son is a dream, and there is nothing in that dream that was not copied from this lamp. The lamp is the real thing. The sun is but a tale, a children's story.
Yes, I see now,
said Jill in a heavy, hopeless tone.
It must be so.
And while she said this, it seemed to her to be very good sense. Slowly and gravely, the witch repeated,
There is no sun.
And they all said nothing. She repeated in a softer and deeper voice,
There is no sun.
After a pause, and after a struggle in their minds, all four of them said together,
You are right.
You are right.
There is no sun.
It was such a relief to give in and say it.
There never was a sun,
said the witch.
No.
No.
There never was a sun,
said the prince and the marsh wiggle and the children. For the last few minutes, Jill had been feeling that there was something she must remember at all costs. And now she did. But it was dreadfully hard to say it. She felt as if huge weights were laid on her lips. At last, with an effort that seemed to take all the good out of her, she said,
There's Aslan.
Aslan,
said the witch, quickening ever so slightly the pace of her thrumming.
What a pretty name. What does it mean? He is the great lion who called us out of our world,
said Scrub.
And sent us into this to find Prince Rillian. What is a lion?
Asked the witch.
Oh, hang it all,
said Scrub.
Don't you know? How can we describe it to her? Have you ever seen a cat? Surely,
said the queen.
I love cats. Well, a lion is a little bit, mind you, like a huge cat with a mane. At least it's not like the horse's mane, you know. It's like the judge's wig. It's yellow. It's terrifically strong.
The witch shook her head.
I see,
she said.
That we should know better with your lion, as you call it, than we did with your son. You have seen lamps. So you imagined a bigger and better lamp, and you call it the sun. You've seen cats, and now you want a bigger and better cat, and it's to be called a lion. Well, 'tis a pretty make-believe thought, to say the truth. It would suit you better if we were younger, and look as if you put nothing in your make-believe without copying it from the world mind, which is the only world. But even you children are too old for such play. As you, my prince, that art a man full grown, fie upon you! Are you not ashamed of such toys? Come, all of you, put away these childish tricks. I have worked for you all the real world. I have worked for you all in the real world. There is no Narnia. No overworld, no sky, no sun, no Aslan, and now, to bed all, let us begin wiser life tomorrow. But first, to bed, to sleep. Deep sleep, soft pillows, sleep without foolish dreams.
The prince and the two children were standing with their heads hung down, their cheeks flushed, their eyes half closed, the strength all gone from them. The enchantment almost complete, but Puddleglum, desperately gathering all his strength, walked over to the fire. Then he did a very brave thing. He knew it wouldn't hurt him quite as much as it would hurt a human, for his feet, which were bare, were webbed and hard and cold-blooded like a duck's. But he knew it would hurt him badly enough, and so it did. With his bare foot, he stamped on the fire, grinding a large part of it into ashes on the flat hearth, and three things happened at once. First, the sweet, heavy smell grew very much less, for though the whole fire had not been put out, a good bit of it had, and what remained smelled very largely of burnt marsh wiggle, which is not at all an enchanting smell. This instantly made everyone's brain far clearer. The prince and the children held up their heads again and opened their eyes. Secondly, the witch, in a loud, terrible voice,
utterly different from all the sweet tones she had been using up till now, called out,
"What are you doing? Dare to touch my fire again, Mudfilth, and I'll turn blood to fire inside your veins."
Thirdly, the pain itself made Puddleglum's head for a moment perfectly clear, and he knew exactly what he really thought. There is nothing like a good shock of pain for dissolving certain kinds of magic.
"One word, ma'am,"
he said, coming back from the fire, limping because of the pain.
"One word. All you've been saying is quite right. I shouldn't wonder. I'm a chap who always likes to know the worst and then put the best face I can on it. So I won't deny any of what you said. But there's one thing more to be said, even so. Suppose we have only dreamed or made up all those things. Trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that in that case, the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the real world. Well, it strikes me as a very pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing. When you come to think of it, we're just babies making up a game, if you're right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I'm going to stand by the play world. I'm on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I'm going to live as like a Narnian as I can, even if there isn't any Narnia. So, thanking you kindly for supper, if these two gentlemen and the young lady are ready, we're leaving your court at once and setting out in the dark to spend our lives looking for the overland. Not that our lives will be very long, I should think. But that's a small loss if the world's as dull a place as you say."
"Oh, hooray! Good old
Puddleglum!"
cried Scrub and Jill. And scene.
And after we've all recovered from the lawsuit from the C.S. Lewis Foundation.
Yes.
Oh, I think there's some sort of fair use parody or I don't know. Not going to worry about that until I get the lawsuit, though.
I sort of wish we could re-record it because I found Puddleglum's voice about halfway through.
I think one take is good. We're good.
I think it would be nice to actually look through this and at one time, at least read through it a couple times before we actually do voices. If you're out there and you want to hire us for voiceover work, I think all of us will take the extra money.
So, so there we are. And let's talk about that a little bit now. Let's talk about how this scene applies and how not just to, you know, the book, but also to just our life and that kind of thing. And then we'll get into some other stuff, which is where the red pill and the blue pill come in.
So, yeah, I actually am glad we did this because I read all of the Narnia books straight through last year, which was the first time I'd actually read the Narnia books. And I had forgotten, you know, except for, you know, obviously you always know Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and I always remember A Horse and the Boy, which is my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
But this one I had forgotten. And reading this, I remember this part. The problem is right after I read this, I tried to read Wicked. There's two books of Wicked, and they were both horrible, Wicked and the one that came after it. were both really bad. I stopped halfway through the second one. And I think some of these blurred together. So I'm glad because I remember this is one of my favorite scenes from all of the Narnia books. And so I'm glad that we did it to separate that in my mind.
Yeah. Cool. Well,
see, I wasn't allowed to read Narnia when I was growing up.
Really? I don't think I remember you saying that.
Yeah, because back then, you know, they were reading Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in schools, and my parents thought it was demonic because it was the lion, the witch, and the wardrobe.
Oh, yeah.
So, So they, you know, they said that if they ever made me read this at school, that I have to complain about it. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I could never read Narnia books growing up. Of course, my parents realized later of C.S. Lewis and that kind of thing. They were pretty young parents. I don't think they were aware of.
Yeah, yeah. Meanwhile, I was introduced to it in public school.
Yeah, yeah. So was I.
You know, I mean, we read it in third grade. And it was my teacher that I hated the most in all my 13 years of school. This was the teacher who, she did not like me. I did not like her. That was the year that I only had her for 4 days. And then on Friday, we had a different teacher come in, and she was my favorite teacher. She was my creative writing teacher, which might say a lot there too. But yeah, she read it to us. It's the one good memory I have of that woman, is that she read out loud a bunch of books to us. And I remember her reading, and still I remember her voice reading different parts of like The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. And
wow.
And
I'm sure she did a better job than we did.
I don't know. You guys, considering you hadn't had a chance to really read it through since I got the idea this morning, and you had to like work and do all that kind of stuff, I think that we did a pretty decent job.
We lost the voices when we had the big monologue.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I think Steve kind of got more into character whenever there was a big monologue. But
I like monologuing.
I'm kind of like, does this woman ever shut up? What's going on?
I think that's the point of it.
And you're also, I'm trying to figure out, am I supposed to be talking now? Because we don't have them in script form. We have it in the actual book form. And you're kind of like, oh, it says, the witch says this. The queen. Oh, the queen and the witch are the same person. Oh, I forgot about that. I should be talking.
Well, it'll be easier when we do the next part. When we move into part two of this conversation. But let's talk about this scene, though. I mean, reading it through right now, there was even more things I was noticing just about the way she was talking to these people about, you know, what's reality and what's not. And, you know, just what's imagined and what's not. And you know, Jill, we come from another world. And she's, oh, well, that's a great game. Tell me more about this other world.
Yeah.
And just that enchantment that she was putting over them. I like the way that she was talking about the sun and the lion. Oh, well, you're just taking these things you've seen in my world, which is the real one, and you're expanding them. Yeah. You know, and that's obviously can't be true.
Right.
So what else kind of stuck out to you? Is there anything?
Well, no, I think that this really is a microcosm of, you know, our world. We're kind of lulled into complacency that this world is the only thing that's here. Forget about God, forget about his kingdom, forget about what he says, because what we can touch, feel, see right here, regardless of how dark and imperfect and incomplete that it is, well, of course, this is the real thing. You know, this other stuff is made up. And I see that all the time. I think this passage is extremely relevant to where we're at, you know, in this time. And I think we need more puddle glums.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, anytime you have the world dictating to you what, this is how I explain it to the kids sometimes. It's sort of like the world shows you this little box that has no sand in it, and says, see, there's no sand. And when you step up a little bit and get a little bit of perspective, you see that this little box is blocking off all the sand that is contained in the huge sandbox that it's surrounding. And yes, they've carved out their little space where there's no sand, and they can say, see, there's no sand, there's no supernaturalism, there's no spirit world, there's only the physical world, and we die and we become the grass. You know, that's all that there is. And you can see there's a much bigger picture. And you can say to yourself, you know, if you want to live in that little box, there you go. But there's so much out here that is only a part of. Yes, atheism is a part of the world and a part of the universe, but it's not the totality of it. And,
you know, there you go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, when I look at Puddle Glims, I remember when I first read the book that he kind of bothered me at first because he was like, yeah, I don't know. He's kind of like ho-hum. But as I'm reading this passage, I think about it. You know, he would never be in our culture the Puddle Glums of our world, so to speak. They're not the popular ones. They're not usually the rich and famous ones. They are the ones that are steady, that are consistent. And the truth is we promote everything but that in our society.
Yep.
It's the flash. It's the most talented. It's not the one, you know, who is the regular down to earth, you know, willing to admit some of these ideas are too big for me. And some of what you say is true, but you know what? I know what is true. I've been there. I've seen this. I've done that. I think right now I'm thinking of a couple people in my life that are a little bit like puddle glums. And, you know, I don't think we appreciate them enough because we're so focused sometimes thinking of the other folks.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one thing that really sticks out to me in here is that it's the pain that clears Puddle Glum's head.
Yeah. I thought about that too.
I think that's really, I mean, all this is a powerful just segment of a book, you know, but obviously the most powerful and strongest segment of the book. And I think this is the emotional climax of the book. There's a lot of action adventure that happens after this, and there's, you know, creatures and all sorts of craziness, but this is the spiritual and emotional climax of it. And it's Puddle Glum who saves the day, basically. And he stomps his foot in the fire. But it's pain that dissolves the magic and allows him to see clearly. And that kind of reminds me of C.S. Lewis's his idea that, you know, pain is a megaphone to arouse a dead world or whatever. I can't remember the exact quote, but the pain is a megaphone that God uses to call, you know, and to bring our, to get our attention in some situation.
Yeah. Hey, Ben, do you mind if I read the quote that you're talking about, God's megaphone?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
There's a whole, I'll read, there's one or two sentences here. The human spirit will not even begin to try to surrender self-will as long as all seems to be well with it. Now, error and sin both have this property, that the deeper they are, the less their victim suspects their existence. They are masked evil. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone that rouses a deaf world. That's from The Problem of Pain.
Yeah, which is, you know, the
pain. Yeah, it goes back to what we're talking about.
The sister book with this book here.
Yeah.
And that's, C.S. Lewis didn't set out to do this, but it's something I've heard people talk about and I've seen myself, is that his fiction books tend to have a nonfiction, a counterpart that goes along with it. And that's, this one, I think, goes along with that ideally. So obviously we are all fans of C.S. Lewis, and I think that there's a reason for that, is because he writes things like this. I mean, this is a fantasy book. It's a child's adventure book. And this segment we just read is so deep with philosophy and Christian ideas and just, it's just deep. It's just deep.
Yeah.
Let's move on then to the kind of the part two of this conversation, which is going to be building on what we just did. We've seen this idea in a lot of science fiction, especially, but even in some fantasy as well, of someone creating another world and basically trapping other people in it. In The Silver Chair, the prince is trapped in, you know, his memory is ripped from him and he's trapped in this world. And if Puddle Glum had not done what he did, you know, they all four of them would have ended up trapped in a world, this underground cave with no light except for what is brought in through a lamp. They'd be in a world that's the witch had created and forced them to stay in. And so I thought we could discuss a few other movies and that kind of thing. But the one that first comes to mind is the one that's also part of our title. And I wanted us to do another dramatic reading. Because this is the scene that after this movie came out, I don't know about you guys, because I'm not sure what kind of, you know, how old you guys were at the time and what you were involved in your life. But for me, for me, I was involved in a lot of youth work. And the youth pastors, this is the scene from this movie. When this movie came out on DVD, this scene got used all over the place.
Over and over again.
In youth conferences, youth groups, and youth Bible studies. And I'm sure that there are even a couple books written about this scene specifically. But
this was the movie.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And for good reason and for bad reason. But this is the scene. Dr. Jace, are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to now do a scene from a secular movie that reflects what we just read from C.S. Lewis. I am going to play the part of Morpheus, and Dr. Jace is going to play the part of Neo.
Am I going to read the Neo nods his head?
Oh, yeah, you can do that. You can read the action.
The narrator,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, ready? I imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole.
Whoa. You could say that.
I could see it in your eyes. You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he's expecting to wake up. Ironically, this is not far from the truth. Do you believe in fate, Neo?
No way, dude.
Why not?
Oh, no. Because I don't like the idea of not being in control of my own life.
I know exactly what you mean. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know, you can't explain, but you feel it. You've felt it your entire life. There's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there. Like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix. Dun, dun, dun.
Do you want to know what that is?
Neo nods his head.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now in this very room. I feel like I'm Christian Bale doing Batman. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work or when you go to church or when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth, dude?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage. Born inside a prison that you cannot smell, taste, or touch. A prison for your mind.
Long pause. Sighs.
Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is the last chance. After this, there is no turning back.
In his left hand, Morpheus shows a blue pill.
You take the blue pill and the story ends. You wake in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe.
A red pill is shown in his other hand.
You take the red pill and you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Long pause. Neo begins to reach for the red pill.
Remember, all I'm offering you is the truth, nothing more.
Neo takes the red pill and swallows it with a glass of water.
I feel like we did a better job on the other one, but...
Well, this was, I think, a little bit more comical. You know, you guys picked it up a little.
Anyway.
Whoa, dude. Whoa, pills, man.
So here's what... I always wonder what would happen if you, like, smashed them together and took a purple pill.
No, I was sitting there thinking, you know, what if he just has a cold and he just needs some cough medicine? You know, they're always, you know, they look kind of like those pills.
I need a cough medicine now. Yeah. Okay, so here we have the Matrix. Which is that idea, then, of the world is not the real world. And everything you know is a lie. And honestly, that lie stinks. You know, we're going to get you out of here if you want. Let's talk a little bit about The Matrix, then. I know that there are some people who this is, like, their favorite movie, their favorite series. And like I said, man, that year... Everyone was using this movie and using that scene in particular. Yeah.
The Matrix was, when I first saw it, was it was at the top of my list. Right, automatically, it shot up the list of one of my favorites of all time. So I was so pumped when they were going to come out with the second and third ones, and then I saw the second and third ones, and now now I choose to believe that those are do not exist.
See, that's those the are the thing, yeah, those are the fake world.
Yeah, they're the fake ones, and this is the only real one.
Actually, I never thought of it that way, but you could. You could say to yourself, those other two movies are the lie.
They are.
They were pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
They're the lie of the big budget Hollywood that just wanted to make another movie. But this is the one true story in the Matrix universe.
You know, I think you could have some fun with some meta knowledge there. And yeah.
That is how I choose to look at it. I do not acknowledge the other two.
So not acknowledging the other two. What do you think about this movie and the way so many people pinned so many spiritual concepts on it, especially Christians?
Which pretty much shows that the brothers who made the name are escaping me right now. Do you guys remember their names?
The Wachowski siblings.
It was kind of, yeah, I knew it was a W. I couldn't know how to pronounce it. Yeah, they're not, I guess one of them.
They're not brothers. They're not
a brother anymore. No. They're one transgender now.
Topic
but,
for another episode.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, the Wachowskis. What are they doing?
It made it me realize that they didn't really know what they did well in this movie because I saw what the other two movies were. Because they missed the fact of that this was something that was really, really spoke to a lot of people. There was a lot of spiritual undertones that I thought were very parallel to, you know, the Christ figure, the type of the savior type of character.
Yeah, and you know, obviously, when you say the Christ figure, Neo is not a perfect.
No, of course not.
Christ, no. You know, metaphor. I tended to look at Neo not so much as the Christ figure as the Christian figure. I got excited when I saw the end of this movie, and he's like, "I'm coming for you," or whatever, you know, and he flies. And I'm thinking to myself, that just promised us an awesome sequel where he is going to save people from the Matrix. He's going to rescue them from within. Yeah. And that's kind of like our mission, is to kind of save people from the Matrix, save people from the lies that they are in bondage to. And that's what resounded with me. And when I say that youth pastors were showing this, I didn't show this as a youth pastor, but I sure did talk about it a lot. with my other youth pastor friends and even, you know, kids from other youth groups and stuff like that. And that's how I felt. I saw Neo fly into the screen, and I'm just like, that's us. That's us. And this is what we're called to do. We're called to save people from the Matrix.
The Matrix.
So,
well, I think, you know, as you guys know, I know with studying stories, one of the most popular threads of storytelling is that of the savior. He was the one. I mean, you see this in Lord of the Rings, the three main characters. I've seen people draw analogies that that Gandalf and Frodo and Aragorn all could have been representative of Christ because they all three died and came back to some degree in the movies.
Oh, and it goes deeper than just the dying. It's prophet, priest, and king.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And you have all these different stories of people want to argue that Harry Potter also is a Christ-like figure. Of course, obviously, none of these characters are perfect. And then you even have like Superman, kind of like this. So for me, it had this metaphor that, you know, Morpheus was like the John the Baptist, the forerunner, so to speak. And there was obviously it breaks down.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not an allegory, so to speak. It's not like it's not a direct representation like an allegory. It was more metaphorical.
I think they were trying to like grab a whole bunch of stuff and put it in there and say, you know, look, we named it the ship the Nebuchadnezzar. See, it's a little biblical here, and you know they're trying
it's
to.
It's a cool sounding Bible name.
Yeah,
that if you really think too much about it.
And then they used the version of the Savior, the everyday Messiah, the person who was nothing and comes up, and they're misunderstanding, you know, the mission of Jesus, the mission of Christ. They don't understand him as this perfect being who was existent before this. They just see you know, oh, he was born and then he grew up and then he became, you know, all that stuff. So it's just a misunderstanding of the whole thing.
Yeah, but again, we're talking metaphor versus allegory. If you tell a story of a perfect being, and he's your main protagonist, it gets kind of, it's kind of like Superman. It's hard to tell a good Superman story. But again, you're right. As the movies went along, you began to realize they really didn't know the ingredients that made the first one work well. Then they started throwing in even more stuff into the second and third one.
Well, and even I think in the first one, they were just throwing things in. Like, they named the ship the Nebuchadnezzar. I can guarantee you they did not think so far as to say, oh, Nebuchadnezzar was a king who ended up worshiping God because he was turned into a beast person or whatever. I mean, they weren't taking it that far. But what they were doing was they were tapping into some truths.
Wait, do you know who wrote it? Did they write it too?
Yeah. As far as I know, they wrote it, I think, with one other person. I haven't looked up to see that.
I'd be curious to know what the writer, you know, because, you know, some of those things, writers' names changed and, you know, it'd be interesting to know what influence the writer had on it.
IMDb it.
I am right now doing that very thing. Written by the two of them. So... yeah, so it was the two of them writing that, and I know that they had planned, you know, the story was, well, we're going to do this first one, and then we're going to, you know, tell as much of the story as we can, but we have the trilogy in mind, and so we're hoping that we get to finish it, but this is just one third of the story.
In mind.
What?
They couldn't possibly have had the trilogy in mind.
I think that they could have. I think they had an idea of where they were wanting to go with it. Back to the movie, though, the movie itself. And its idea of this real world, I think that really caught on to a lot of people. I think a lot of people caught on to it because there's all this action and stuff, but I think another part of it was it caught that idea that people have. They know there's something wrong with this world. And that speech, I mean, that comes from, I think, a heartfelt, you know, there's something wrong with this world. And I think you look at our world today, you feel that. There's something wrong with this world. And the idea of right and wrong has to come from somewhere. But
I ask my students all the time, because people always want to say, you know, even Neo says this comes up all the time. What is truth?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jesus had the same conversation with Pilate, and you hear this all the time in different movies. What is truth? Well, you know, we always want to say that things are relative, but if we're sitting in a room with a crowded group of people and a 6'7" muscle bound guy comes in and he cold cocks an 80-year-old woman, what would you be thinking? And my students will be like, I'd be angry. I'd be upset. Well, why? Because that's wrong. Nobody should be doing that. Well, who says? The moment you say that something is wrong, you're saying there's a moral absolute.
Yeah,
well, where does that moral absolute come from? Because in, you know, we're taught scientifically that it's survival of the fittest, yet at the same time, socially, we're saying that there's a right and wrong. Well, it can't be both. There has to be a moral absolute somewhere.
And there is an answer that some people give for that, and that's that we act in the self-interest of our species.
Yeah.
And so we want to protect the weak of our species, and that's why cute animals, we like cute animals because they remind us of babies, and we have an innate instinct to protect babies.
No,
which
but
makes
I know,
no sense and, if but, you think but, about it as the survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The counter argument is that by getting rid of the weak, we actually make our species stronger.
Right, right. And beyond even that, this idea of, well, is it wrong to hit that old woman? I just can't understand. And I need to actually ask this question of an actual, like, atheist. If you are an atheist, how can you really even say that it is wrong?
Yeah.
You know, there is nothing holding you to any kind of moral behavior except for a desire to stay out of prison, maybe, or, you know, the desire to protect your family. But at the same time, I can't see it. I can't understand this. You know, how can you have a morality and enforce a morality?
You can't. Is murder wrong? No, not without the Bible. Is stealing wrong? Not without the Bible. When you sit there and you actually break it down and you ask someone, well, why is it wrong? Why? there is nothing to really hold it down other than, well, we know, whereas a Christian, we know. We have the Bible. Yeah. We have, you know, the voice of God to let us know what's right and what's wrong.
And he's written that law on our hearts.
Yes.
You know, I mean, this is something that you can train yourself and make yourself believe that something that is wrong is actually right. But
the Bible even says that we have our own conscience, that we know, you know, the right and wrong, and we just choose to ignore it.
Yeah, and that's...
God's given us a conscience, and we go against our conscience because, as Puddle Glum and all of them experience, we get lulled in, humanity gets lulled in that it's not real, that conscience, that thing inside that says this is wrong, oh, well, why is it wrong? That doesn't make sense. That's childish. That's you know, only little children believe in that stuff.
Yeah.
You made that up really nice.
That stuff in Romans is what I really like, the way Paul kind of gets into the whole, I'm not going to even find it right now, but beginning of Romans.
Romans 1 and 2?
Romans 1 and 2. I think it's 2 that I'm thinking.
Is it 118?
118 says, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of the people. That's not what I'm thinking of, though.
I know.
I'm thinking of 20. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. And for although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him, but in their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal. It's just that idea that, you know, it is written on our hearts. We see it in nature. We see God. You know, there is no excuse. Can you guys think of any other movies then, or books or anything that uses this element of the real world is not, or the world is not the real world, and that you're living in a lie, and it gets revealed?
Oblivion.
Yeah. Yep. That was second on my list, just because the first thing on my list was, it's just another special one to me, but yeah, Oblivion. Good grief, that movie.
That movie made me angry.
Have you guys had a chance to listen to the podcast I recorded with Matt Anderson?
Haven't had a chance, Sci-Fi Christian?
No, okay. I went off on that movie for lots of different reasons. None of the reasons, I shouldn't say none of the reasons, but Dr. Jace, you went and saw it with a friend who like understands and knows about Scientology and saw a whole bunch of stuff in there.
Yeah, I was interested to go with him because I knew that he studied that. It was interesting. He's a friend of mine who I respect as a theologian and who actually was a fan of mine as an actor. He would follow some of the things I did here and there.
That's cool.
But I knew him when I was doing my doctorate, and then he kept up with me as I went to Hollywood and different things, and so he's a good friend of ours, so we went, and I was, throughout most of the movie, I'm kind of like, well, I have some issues with it from a aesthetic and an excellent storytelting perspective, but I thought it was pretty, I thought it looked cool, I thought there was some fun things. I thought it was fairly predictable, but then I don't want to give it away. But there was a couple moments in the movie that just ruined the whole thing for me because it was just basically, you know, I think the problem is because I know Tom Cruise's worldview. I know that, you know, him and a few other actors he chooses movies to some degree. Not everyone, of course, but the ones that kind of reflect his view. So I was curious to see what my friend had to say. And the movie was basically, you know, how we would say Matrix had like a Christian worldview. It had some other stuff, but it had a lot of people argued for the Christian worldview. This, Oblivion, had a strong Scientology worldview.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Jace.
Yeah.
Without getting too deep into it, because we don't want to, you know, take this whole episode about Oblivion, but if you didn't know about Tom Cruise's worldview, do you think that you might have looked at this as more of an like a Matrix type of thing where you can see, oh, no, wow, that could be.
No, know, because of mainly because of how the movie ended. I can't really say it more without giving it away.
Right, right.
Because of how the movie ended, had I known nothing about it, it was leading up towards, and the way it kind of, the denouement, so to speak, it really shared the worldview of the film, because I process stories through, you know, different lenses, and I wouldn't have come away with it with a Scientology worldview. I would have interpreted it as an atheistic or a humanistic worldview.
Yeah, I could see going humanistic with it.
Regardless of the Scientology, and then when you add the Scientology element to it, it makes it a little bit more clear that it probably has a more of a Scientology worldview to it. Yeah.
So we can't really discuss too much without really spoiling the entire thing. Not that I feel bad about that, because
the story
made me very, very angry.
And the movie's so predictable, you could probably figure it out in the first 5 minutes.
Well, they try to throw in other twists as well then. I think it was like, oh, they're going to catch this one coming. We better think of something else to be a twist. And I just, from a storytelling perspective, it made me very angry. It just felt very lazy. From a visual perspective, if you are just wanting to watch some awesome-looking sci-fi stuff... Yeah. Good grief, this movie is amazing. Oh,
yeah. The shots, the visuals were stunning.
Yeah, and my recommendation for people is, you know, don't worry about buying this on DVD or getting it from Redbox. See it in a theater. Go to the dollar theater if that's what it takes. But
I even enjoyed the characters. Like, I enjoyed the interaction. The story just was lacking overall, I think.
Yeah, it was. It was. Steve, can you think of anything? Because I thought of one that I thought you might mention. Actually, two that I thought you might mention, Steve.
What?
Ray Bradbury, Mars is Heaven.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Good one.
Thank you.
What's the other one?
Twilight Zone. I don't remember the name of the episode, but it's the one where the guy is living in a world where he gets whatever he wants. I think he's a gambler.
Boy.
What?
It's the little boy.
No. This is a guy. He's like a gambler, and he gets whatever he wants. He, he'll roll the dice and always get perfect. And like the races he bets on are always going to be like they always come in. Just that kind of thing. He has women on his arm, you know, and everything like that. But then it turns out the big Twilight Zone twist. And if you don't want to hear this, now is the time to take out your earbuds for like 2 seconds, because I'm going to spoil it. But it turns out, here's the twist. He's actually in hell.
Yeah.
Because he's a gambler and there's no risk. And so he has no joy in what he's doing. And he's realizing that he can only win. He can't lose. And it's not real. And it's all. I like that. So, okay. Well, you can't hear me now, but put your earbuds back in if you don't want to get spoiled there.
I think not in the same way, but basically it's in almost reverse, is the Truman Show.
Oh, yeah. That I hadn't thought about that one.
His life and his world was fake, and it wasn't real life. And so he had this revelation that that he was living a lie.
Well, and that's the thing. Around the same time, you had the Truman Show... We should look up what year Truman Show came out in.
Ed TV came out shortly after.
Truman Show was 98. Matrix was 99. You guys remember the movie The 13th Floor?
Yep.
I didn't see it.
Well, it's the same kind of thing where it's 99. There's layers of virtual reality.
Oh, if it's good, don't tell me about it.
I'm not telling you anything more than that. I'm just saying it was 99 as well.
Is it worth seeing?
I remember liking it. It's on Netflix. I remember liking it, but I don't remember much about it other than it's like they're going through and it's kind of a cool, there's kind of some meta knowledge there because it takes place in Las Vegas, and they use computer graphics to like wipe out the power lines and stuff because it takes place in like the 60s or something like that. And so it's kind of cool because you realize, oh, we're watching this movie about a virtual world and they're using virtual technology to create it as well. And then there was a terrible, awful, yucky movie that I do not recommend anyone see. 1999, though. Existence.
I never heard of that one.
It's David Cronenberg. Starred Jude Law. And it is bizarre and weird and has these weird sexual overtones, undertones. I don't know. It's law.
I don't think we're going to do an episode on that one, are we?
Well, we're doing it right now. But all these movies are around the same time, and they're all about this, you know, the world is not what you think it is, and you're living in a lie.
Yeah.
So, Mars is Heaven. I don't want to get into that. It's a short story by Ray Bradbury, though. Check it out. Listen to it or read it or whatever.
It's audio version and probably suspense and stuff like that, old time radio.
Yeah, you can probably find, maybe we could find a link to it even. And then you have the one that I've been waiting. Well, how about this though? I think every season of Next Generation had an episode where someone was captured by a bad guy or trapped in the holodeck where they thought it was reality. I remember Riker being caught by Romulans. And he wakes up and he's living a world. He's living in a world where people are trying to trick him into revealing top secret information. And I think Next Generation did this a lot. Oh, and then what was the most famous? What's that episode with Captain Picard where he's living that other person's
light?
Yeah, the inner light.
The inner light.
So
that is one of my favorite episodes ever.
And it's one of his greatest performances, I think.
Yeah.
Well, I think what you got in Picard is that he was never able to have a family. But in that one story, he was able to have a family and live a full life. So for those, it kind of scratched that itch, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there is the one I've been saving. So if you guys have anything else to add, add it now. No? Yes?
Go ahead. Right.
Waterworld. No, listen to this. You may not like the movie, but listen to this one thing from Waterworld. The woman and Kevin Costner are talking, and I don't remember her name. I don't remember her as an actress, but
Triplehorn.
What?
I think it's Jean Triplehorn.
Okay.
The main actress?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talking to Kevin Costner. Kevin Costner says something like, why do you even believe land exists? And she says, because we're not made for water. And that was a spiritual connection for me about this world that we are in. Yeah, it is the Matrix. We're not made for this world. We're made for heaven. We're made for glory. We're made.
When we realize how imperfect, and we have a desire for perfection. We realize that things are fallen and things are not as they should be. We realize we're not as we should be.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And so it lends itself that there's something bigger, something greater.
So it's not a virtual reality kind of thing. It's not a fake reality kind of thing, but it is a recognition of reality and of the world and saying, hey, I don't fit in this world. Because I'm not made for this world. There's got to be land.
Yeah.
Because we don't, well, other than Kevin Costner, we don't have gills. So, the movie itself, that's a topic for another day. So
I like that movie.
What?
Ooh. I like that movie.
I know. Me too. Horrible. I kind of liked it too.
Horrible. But... horrible. One of the worst.
So why is this theme so popular in pop culture? Have we answered that question?
Well, it's because... Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I'll riff off of you. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think it's all what we've been talking about. It's because there's something in us that knows that the way the world is, there has to be more. There has to be more. And that's why these movies they resonate with something inside of us that goes, you know what? There's something bigger. There's something more. It is not just what we can see, feel, and touch. There's something more.
And Steve, you going to riff off of that?
Yeah. Coming from a non-Christian worldview, you have this reality that people don't like, the sinful world that basically we've created. But we don't want to say that we've created it. We want to say that we can get ourselves out of it. And many of these hero stories, many of these stories where you have this messiah, this sullied version of a savior, it's about us digging ourselves out of the hole that we've dug.
Mm-hmm.
And of course it's not couched that way, but it's just that perpetuating myth that continued struggle will save you. Your works have merit. Your works mean something in the long run. And it cycles. And if you fall for that lie, that's the lie of the world. That's the lie of the devil.
All right. Good. Fun conversation, guys. Are we ready to move on to our hailing frequencies? Or did you have anything more to add?
Nope. Let's go on to hailing frequencies. Away.
All right.
Hailing frequencies open.
We got two messages from Hank Harwell. And then one thing I want to read, because I'm not bringing in Shazbot. I just can't. I can't bring him in today. So
why?
Why not?
We'll talk about that later. But right now, let's just focus on what's important. That's Hank Harwell. This first one is actually a response to our Steven Spielberg episode.
Hey guys, it's Hank Harwell again, and I'm on driving on a business trip, so I had a chance to listen to a couple episodes and just finished the Steven Spielberg one. And I was just wondering if anybody else had heard about that you can trace some of Spielberg's daddy issues, for lack of a better phrase, through his films, in that he grew up in a single parent household, his folks were divorced, and he always had some sort of estrangement issues with his father, and that a lot of that is reflected in many of his films, you know, from Close Encounters, Hook, the Indiana Jones movies, especially Last Crusade. And you can kind of almost see how there's a progression and a growth even as he's worked through some of those and even become a parent himself. Anyway, I didn't know if any of y'all had heard of that before, or if there's any other thoughts on that. So I'll just leave that work with you. And again, another solid episode, and look forward to hearing more, guys. Take care. Bye.
The father issues is something that I did notice in E.T. when I even first saw it, because the father in E.T. is never even seen. He's gone off to Mexico with some woman, and that's a big deal for the mom. You know, she's crying because he doesn't even like Mexico. So that is something. And then I never thought of tying in like Last Crusade, where you have the hero dealing with his father who's estranged. What do you think?
I think, you go from what you know. You know, if that's the life that you've grown up in, and you say, this needs a little bit more drama, a little bit more impact, you're going to go with something that impacted you. And if that's, family strife, then that's what you're going to get.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know his personal life or how he grew up. I've heard little things here and there, but I mean, the truth is, when you're working with kids, if you want them to relate, usually there's going to be some kind of conflict with the parents, whether it be in fun or some serious issue.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on the genre of the film. So it's also a good story device because it's something that most people can relate to on some level.
Yeah, but you get into Hook there. And if you kind of look at Hook as almost like a wish fulfillment. I mean, Peter Pan is a wish fulfillment story in a lot of ways. If you look at Hook as, in some ways, maybe Steven Spielberg's wish fulfillment, it's all about a father who stops being estranged.
I wished it was a good movie and it wasn't fulfilled.
We're not going to get into that conversation again.
It's a fun movie.
Although Daniel Butcher on Facebook, he definitely liked it. Okay, so we have another message from...
Me and Daniel Butcher seem to agree on a lot of things.
We got another message from Hank.
Hi, guys. Just finished listening to the episode on the feedback. This is Hank Harwell, and sorry, but it seemed like I took over. I didn't really mean to, and just, I guess that's how the feedback fell. Just wanted to comment on a couple of things. The first is on the Akira Kurosawa Western connection. I actually have I studied film in college, and that was one of the things that came up in a survey of film class was that he was using those tropes to do this samurai film. I can't tell you what book it was in or the notes or anything like that. I just remembered that's where the first place I heard it was in college. Second thing is on the Green Hornet Lone Ranger connection. There is actually an episode of the Green Hornet floating around out there somewhere where Britt Reed is talking to his father and he reveals to him that he's the Green Hornet, and the Britt's father says that they had an ancestor who went about the countryside righting wrongs. And as he's having this conversation, as having this discussion, and he's telling him about this ancestor, you hear the theme music from the Lone Ranger playing softly in the background. They never come right out and say that he was the Lone Ranger, but the connection is just about unmistakable. So I thought you'd appreciate that.
All right, Steve, Old Time Radio, yes. Do you know what episode that was from? I want to hear it.
I'm going to have to think about it a little bit more.
All right. Well, look into it, because I do want to hear that. Okay, so one last piece of feedback. This is normally something we would probably give to Shazbot to do, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to go ahead and read it. This is from a listener named Andrew, who left it on our website. He said, fun podcast, just a couple thoughts. This is on our Spielberg episode. I agree with everything you mentioned that made Jurassic Park appealing, but there was one more thing that made it special to me. It was the first film with good enough special effects to convince me that a decent Lord of the Rings film was possible. As soon as I saw those brachiosaurus at the start of the film, I was certain. Of course, I had no idea just how much special effects technology would improve in the years leading up to the filming of the Lord of the Rings, making it many times better than I'd imagined from a technical standpoint. You guys want to address that, or should I move on to his next point?
No, that's good for me.
Okay. Dr. Jace?
I'm good.
Sounds like, he says then, I liked Indiana Jones and Kingdom of the Crystal Skull better than you guys. It wasn't a great film, but then again, I wasn't expecting a great film. I found it to be a mostly pleasant, if imperfect, indie romp. I didn't mind the sci-fi theme, but I did mind the fact that the artifact was generic compared to the legendary ones in Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Last Crusade. I mean, compare. The Ark of the Covenant, the Holy Grail, and some skull? Meh. So... I almost don't agree with that part, though. The crystal skull is actually like an archaeological discovery. There are people who have found. In fact, Lucasfilm was being sued by an archaeologist who found a crystal skull down in South America. Yeah. He was like, you know, oh, you're taking this idea from my discovery or something like that. So
yeah, and if in the context of the whole thing, the crystal skull is this overarching, super incredible find that resets everything. You know, it's the proof of aliens. You know, it's that thing.
But I understand what he's saying, though.
Yeah, I know, just a crystal skull. But the thing is, that the way it's couched is it's greater than the Holy Grail. It's greater than the.
You guys don't like You don't like Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull?
No. No, it was horrible.
We've done an episode about that. Okay,
let's be honest. That was at least better than Temple of Doom.
No, it wasn't.
See?
Nope.
I like Temple of Doom. It's my third on the list, and it's a far third. But it's still on the side of I can live with it. I could watch that again. I couldn't watch Crystal Skull again.
See, I was expecting something epic from Indiana Jones. It had been, what, 20 years or something?
Yes, exactly.
And they got back, you know, Harrison Ford, and they got back the actress from the first movie. And just so many things just seemed like it was just going to be this overarching, wonderful throwback, yet at the same time, all the new special effects and everything. And it was like Indiana Jones and the green screen for half of the thing. It was just, and
yeah. All right. Well, let's move on.
I don't want to take up all your time.
let's move on, guys.
I'll go back to my refrigerator.
Too late, Mr. Tangent.
I think it's time to move on.
Tangent? I stayed on topic.
It's time to move on. Let's talk about theme week. I think it will be probably our next episode is going to be part of the Christian Geek Podcast theme week that we are doing with 8 other podcasts, including Are You Just Watching, Faith, Hope, and Nerds, Game Store Profits, Geek This Podcast, Geekily Yoked, Holy Worlds Podcast, The Sci-Fi Christian, and Story Men. And I'm going to put links to them in our show notes for this episode. On Facebook, during the theme week, I think we're actually going to do a little spotlight for all of these guys so we can kind of point all of our listeners in that direction to find these guys. We're all doing the same theme. The theme will be superheroes. And we're all just kind of taking that one theme, that word, that idea, and just kind of taking it and going in our own direction with it. But we're all doing this together to just kind of drum up interest for other podcasts, for other listeners. So I'm very, very excited about that. In fact, what's cool has been, I appeared on the Geek This podcast. David Clements interviewed me on his podcast. And in fact, I was even going to play a clip from that interview in this episode, maybe, because I talk a little bit about how I got to know you guys and how our podcast came about. He really likes our podcast.
Cool.
I also appeared on the Sci-Fi Christian as an interviewee subject, not just as a, you know, special guest, but like as a, you know, they interviewed me about my comic book work, which caused some problems, caused some strife on our own show between me and the podcast host that is not on today's episode. That'd be Shazbot.
I do have a background in counseling. Do you guys need to sit down and work it out?
I don't know if I can talk to him.
Well, that's a step to reconciliation is talking. Yeah.
All right, I'll bring him out. I'll bring him out. Shazbot, well, how do I start this, Dr. Jace? What do I say?
Just push the start button, I guess.
Well, Ben, what are you feeling? What's the problem?
Well, my feelings are hurt because Shazbot is actually like he spent time at Daniel's house, didn't tell me, and he like just showed up on their episode. Like they brought him in to help interview me on their episode.
I get the impression that you're feeling a little betrayed.
I am.
You just wanted
Ben,
to spotlight
I
all
promise
yourself.
You, I did not mean to hurt you. Whatever it might be that I did.
I think you know what you did. Shazbot, you even said you guys remember this, right? He even said he wanted to go over to the Sci-Fi Christian. You remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
But Ben, I was just going through a rough time when I was considering working for them. Then I saw how they treated our hosts, like they did that other guy, chap.
Yeah.
Also, it would mean making Luckett's change schools to move up there to Minnesota. Minnesota is a nice place to visit, and we love checking out the biggest ball of twine in Minnesota, but I would not want to live there.
I don't know what you mean about living there, but...
Plus, they don't pay as well as you do.
But...
Wow.
Wait, you get paid?
Yeah, we're like, all I'm doing is let you plug into my wall here at my house, Shazbot, which is part of why I'm betrayed.
Like I said, they don't pay as well as you guys.
So let me ask Ben, if Sci-Fi Christian invite me or Steve over, Do we have to tell you first?
No. That's not a problem.
Are there forms?
We're talking about a robot who lives in my house.
Oh, okay.
And I have sheltered his family, and he's a robot. You guys aren't robots.
Maybe I'm
a robot. So basically,
and he goes over. He's like in Minnesota.
So basically, in the Next Generation episode where Data is on trial is whether or not he's a sentient being or whether or not he's just machinery. You would side that he's just machinery.
Yeah, that is a great episode, but they got it all wrong. I mean, I just can't believe you went up there and did that. It appeared on their show.
What are you talking about? I haven't been to Minnesota in 12 years, when my wife was maid of honor in Rosie the Robot's fifth marriage.
Rosie the Robot got married 5 times? That was her fifth marriage?
I'm not one for conspiracy theories. But can it be coincidence that every husband she has suffers a catastrophic malfunction within 2 years after getting married? Let's just say I would not marry her.
Okay. Well, you're already married, so...
Wait, is the fifth one, is that the toaster, or is...
I'm telling you, I don't know what you are talking about. I haven't left Indiana since 2012.
But I heard you. And you were there. He was talking to you. He had you ask me questions. It sounded just like you.
Oh, dear. Ben, this is not good.
What, yeah, I know. It is not good that you did this.
No, I mean that was not me. If it sounded like me, then it could only be one thing.
Yeah, what's that?
My twin brother, Razbit.
Razbit?
I knew it. I could feel it.
What? So your twin brother was there?
You don't understand. He is my evil twin brother. Evil.
Wait, you've got a twin brother, and he's evil, and he's a robot.
Yes, Razbot is my evil twin brother. He was rejected by the Walt Disney theme parks when he wanted to work in their Hall of Presidents, but they said he didn't have enough personality. Now he hates all humans. And he is in Daniel Butcher's house.
Yeah, he is.
Daniel Butcher, you are in grave danger.
Well, that's it for this episode, then. Guys, any last words?
Mars is heaven.
Yeah, I'm not gonna talk any more about Sci-Fi Christian until I'm actually on their show. I've not been able to be on their show, and so they're dead to me.
It's not anything they've done. Oh. I mean,
I know. I think it's a conspiracy.
I think that, Dr. Jace, you're going to find that that reality is not real, and that
it's as unreal as Matrix 2 and 3.
Well, I would like to say thank you for listening, everyone, and thank you for giving us feedback. I do want to remind you one last time, we have extended the deadline for your recording. If you are going to send us a recording or leave us a voicemail message about what changed sci-fi for you, the deadline is now May 15th. You can leave us a message just by calling, you know, just write it down real quick and then call and read it into our voicemail at 1-804-37-ALIEN. And the other thing you can do is you can, you know, record it on your computer and send us an audio file to podcast@strangersandaliens.com. We've gotten some really, really interesting messages. We're going to include, each of us are going
to
include.
Wait, does any of those include an apology from Sci-Fi Christian on my behalf?
No, it doesn't. Okay.
Wow, and I don't care.
You guys are real delicate psyches.
Yeah. I'm calling out Matt, I'm calling out Kobe and Daniel and whoever else is over there, Sci-Fi Christian. I've got my eye on you.
All right, I think it's time to say goodbye, guys.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Godspeed. You've been listening to the Strangers and Aliens podcast, hosted by Ben Avery, Steve MacDonald, and Dr. Jace O'Neill. Our music was composed and mixed by Tim Leffel. Please join in the conversation by visiting our website, strangersandaliens.com, where you will find show notes, articles, reviews, and more. You can also email us directly at podcast@strangersandaliens.com, or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/strangers, or you can leave us a voicemail on the Strangers and Aliens hotline. Just call 1-804-37-ALIEN and leave your message. And once again, thanks for listening. Hey, Steve, you're really quiet right now.
Sorry about that. I'm just going to clear my throat for a second. Hold on a second.
Yeah, tangent. Can you keep it down? Use your cough right. button.
Testing.
One, you two, do. Three. Actually, he does have a mute button on his microphone.
I do.
Yeah. Does he?
Yeah.
Check it out.
That was cool. Wow. Okay, so wow, here...
Wow, the podcast sounds so much better now.
Anyway.
Anyway, so